Welcome to Hands at the Table. I'm your co-host, Jeff Bramhall. Alongside fellow massage therapist, Boris Aranyi, this podcast shows massage therapists how powerful our profession can be. We believe that as a craft and as a profession, massage therapy is only limited by a therapist's imagination and willingness to put in the work. By sharing what we're learning, what we're working on, and what's captured our interest, we hope to broaden your perspective, inspire you to set your standard high, and invest in your craft. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to Hands at the Table with Jeff and Bori. We're back again today with a book review that Jeff read, and the title is How Emotions Are Made. So if you have read this book before, then listen up, because we're going to talk about that and go into some details. So Jeff, take it away. Why is this book? How was it?
Awesome. Yeah. So the book, How Emotions Are Made, it was released in 2017. It was written by Lisa Feldman Barrett, who is a neuroscientist at Northeastern University here in Boston.
Which, close by.
Yeah, exactly. pretty close by, which really opens up some things mm-hmm. in my mind. But I was drawn to this book. I was drawn to this book because I'd heard her interviewed a few years ago when a more recent of her books, which is more focused on like building specific habits towards brain health, came out. And I remember listening to her talk and just kind of like grabbing onto it, but then never actually followed through with reading the books. And so about this point, it's probably about a year ago, I picked up How Emotions Are Made and started slowly making my way through it, and ended up rereading a bunch of portions of it over the past couple of years, over the past handful of months. And there's a couple of things that coming out of this book. Oh, I guess first I'll talk about a little bit about the structure of the book and how it's written in a similar way to Siddhartha Mukherjee's Emperor of All Maladies, or those like that kind of realm of like a little bit historian, a little bit of history interleaved with science. And the fundamental belief that, or the fundamental principle that Feldman Barrett puts into the book is that our conception of emotions as universal and fixed is incorrect, and it is incorrect because it's built on bad science, and and it's both built on bad experimental science, and it's built on a misunderstanding or an oversimplification of the physical structure of the brain. So she not only comes into this book, she comes out like elbows super wide. So she comes into this book saying, first, the triune brain model is wrong. The idea that you have like a lizard brain and then you have the other brain sitting on top of it that regulates the lizard brain. She's like, yeah, that's a pile of junk. And then furthermore, she goes into, I think maybe you've seen the pictures of, I think it's the seven universal emotions, where you have like anger and disgust and fear, and you have all of those images, you have the images that go along with them. Like those, I just always think of the woman's face of disgust. Yeah. And that one always comes to my mind.
Or you can think about the Pixar movie. Have you seen it? The
No.
Ocean Ones?
Oh, you know, I never watched that.
You see, I just saw it. So definitely, you know,
okay.
That's something that, and especially after this book, you're going to be like, horribly wrong.
This is horribly wrong, but at least it's
cute.
Entertaining.
It's cute. It's entertaining. Yeah. It's fun. Yes.
So she goes into talking about that as like, she discusses that in like, she basically does like a review of the experiments that led to those where images were shown to like I think the way that I had been introduced to that idea ages ago was you could show anybody on earth a picture of a person looking disgusted and they would know what disgust was. Yep. Or you could show anyone on earth a picture of surprise and they would know what surprise was. The idea that she's refuting, in addition to the triune brain model, is that our categorizations of emotions are fixed. Mm-hmm.
Meaning that it's fixed in time. So like we always, like this is disgust for us and we can't change that picture. Is that
or
how she means it, that it's fixed?
I think she means it more that it's fixed in that everyone knows, everyone and every human being knows what this is, and it's innate to our being humans to know what that is. And she posits in a way that I found very compelling that rather than a fixed set of emotions that are universal, that our emotions are actually built out of concepts. Mm-hmm. And those concepts are introduced to us are socially introduced to us. Mm-hmm. And so our ability to recognize an emotion in another person, or our ability to name an emotion that we're experiencing in ourselves is based on the concepts of emotions that we've been exposed to through our life. So mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So basically what she's saying, that you learn those things, or like when you start socializing at an early age, that's when you get the feedback that this is happiness, this is sadness, this is anger. So you kind of, there's like a learning process.
And even a step beyond that, this is sadness, this is happiness. This is an experience and we're going to call it happiness. This is an experience with a positive affect and we're going to call it happiness. Mm-hmm. And then calling it happiness puts a name onto it. Right. So, and then when you put a name onto it, you then develop a concept in your mind, and then that concept in your mind crystallizes into this concept of happiness. And then you pattern match onto those. And then your brain as a pattern matching system matches things into happiness. And then it grows what the concept of happiness is or what it can be and so forth. And okay. I found that on its own, both like liberating and compelling, and also made a lot of sense it made sense to me in the way that she explained it. And more than that, it also clarifies what it opens up possibilities of what we can do. So the book itself is pretty amazing it's bold as hell, but then also what I think was really interesting and what was most relevant to me as a body worker was how she introduced the concept a concept in neuroscience called predictive coding, which we'd actually talked about. We talked about a bit of that with Eddie way back when we did the Science of Touch episodes, and he speaks a lot about that as his intention in body work is based in predictive coding. And that's the part where I think this book can make a really great bridge for us, can bridge into why what we do works and how what we do works. But before diving into that, so one of the concepts that Feldman Barrett talks about that I thought was really interesting was how we define emotion, how emotions are defined across cultures. For instance, you know, in some and how our the language that we have available dictates or interacts with the way that we're able to describe our internal world, like our felt, our experience. Mm-hmm. So one of the studies that she cited was about how people who have wider vocabularies and who have a vocabulary that crosses that, and people who speak multiple languages have a tendency to be happier. And she posits that their overall life satisfaction comes because they're able to be more precise in the language that they use to describe their affect, affective, like, you know, their feeling, how they feel. And I just thought that was like absolutely fascinating, because one of the things that we always hear about is like, oh, travel makes your life so rich, and you know, you get to spend time around other people. And there's like actual like neuroscience that validates that.
Wow.
So learning another language, like one of the things that we talked about a few months ago was how, and I don't even think we put this onto a podcast, but like the language of emotions mm-hmm. in Hungarian versus English, and you're just like, mm-hmm. yeah, it's different. Like one of the challenges moving back to Budapest from the US is that I have to come up with, like, I have to figure out language for things that we don't have Hungarian mm-hmm. words for. Mm-hmm. And so there's this really amazing ability there that we have to like broaden our language which will then have an effect of giving ourselves more ways to conceptualize our feelings, mm-hmm. which gives us more accuracy in expressing what we're feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's where we start to bridge into this predictive coding idea. This is something that this predictive coding, this is the hill that I think I might die on, where I think predictive coding, like the concept of predictive coding is that our brain predicts the future, like our brain, like mm-hmm. through the like allostasis, right? Like our body is always preparing itself for what's next. Right. It's like that's how everything works. Right. Right.
Yeah. 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 You're not getting surprised every second of your life, right? Like, well, you have an expectation.
Ideally, you're not getting surprised every second of your life, right?
Yeah.
So the idea of predictive coding is that our brain says something's going to happen, and then the difference between what our brain says is going to happen and what actually happens, that delta is what we experience as affect, or what we mm-hmm. experience as that is actually the delta that makes up the bulk of our experience of mm-hmm. our lives. Mm-hmm. So we can expect something's going to be uncomfortable, and then it isn't uncomfortable. And the outcome mm-hmm. is this feeling of relief. We expect something's going to be like, we expect something is going to be comfortable, and then it's not comfortable. And we have a negative associated affect, mm-hmm. right? Like you burn your head, like you don't think, mm-hmm. you don't think the stove is going to be hot. You put your hand on it, it's hot, negative feel, like, mm-hmm. like, you know, there's the peripheral nerve stuff that happens, but also you have this, like, you have this mismatch between there's like part of you getting your hand away is also like the withdrawal reflex, but also it's the surprise that comes along with it. So what Feldman Barrett talks about is a lot of this stuff from a mental standpoint, like how do we feel good in our lives. And what I think is really interesting is how we can start to conceptualize our work as body workers through this lens. And this is where I think, like, this is the part of the thing where I'm like, oh yeah, this is the hill to die on. So if we can introduce So if our body wants to conserve energy and mismatch has, and it is metabolically expensive to have mismatches, right? Because that's when you have to marshal a bunch of extra resources to get that to like with that withdrawal reflex is more like it burns more calories to like to withdraw than it does to like leave your hand on something, right? So our body is always trying to burn use fewer calories. So there's like a metabolic cost here. And what we do as body workers, because we know that, you know, we aren't strong enough to stretch fascia, because fascia takes the tensile strength of fascia is very, very high. Mm-hmm. We don't stretch muscles. Muscles don't mm-hmm. get like, there's a concept that muscles don't actually even get longer, mm-hmm. but our clients leave feeling better. So what the fuck? Mm-hmm. And so using Feldman and they don't feel better because we're magicians. Mm-hmm. They feel better because we're applying some sort of a stimulus to their body, which introduces additional error into the system of prediction and error. So thinking about this in terms of range of motion, right? Like say we're looking at range of motion at a hamstring, for instance. You know, you do a straight leg raise. Like I'm gonna use a test that we all know is crappy, right. But who cares?
Yeah.
You're gonna do a straight leg raise till mm-hmm. someone starts to feels a stretch on the back of their leg, and then we do maybe you do then what and then we do a so and that stretch that someone feels is the experience of feeling that stretch. Is their brain saying, ooh, you're getting close to the end. Mm-hmm. Like you can't go further than this. And then, you know, you lay the leg down. Maybe you do some breathing work. You get their pelvic floor to drop. You get their lower back to drop, blah, 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 blah. Whatever happens, happens, mm-hmm. right? You do that same straight leg raise again, and you gain 15 degrees of range of motion. Mm-hmm. It's not like the hamstring itself got longer to mm-hmm. some degree. Yeah. There might be a pelvic floor position. Like there might be a pelvic position that's changed, mm-hmm. but also through that breathing work, their brain has settled into a more parasympathetic dominant mm-hmm. state. And it's the parasympathetic dominant state that then yields a change in range of motion because the brain is less there's been a prediction of an error in their prediction of where the point of breaking is or where the point of tension is.
Okay.
So we're able to then it works. That introducing that error is what makes our work, I think.
Mm-hmm. So does it mean that like being in a more parasympathetic state, is it less predictive? Do you think?
Is it
where the space comes in? Because like this sounds like the neuroscience or like one of the explanation of the space that we are creating, and we mm-hmm. claim that we talked about this many, many times that yeah. what we're doing is creating space and time. But this would be kind of like, okay, because we're giving it a different input. Maybe we're slowing down the prediction or letting it like giving it a little bit more of a window to predict in, or, you know, because like I know about that. It's like once an error happens, you have an opportunity to learn, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you're supposed to do something different there. And maybe like parasympathetic state is a state where you are more open to different possibilities or different experiences or different inputs or feelings, right?
I think that's it. I think it's uh-huh. that we're creating space to allow for error into a prediction cycle. And I think, and like, this is like, I'm fuzzy on like, is it the parasympathetic state that does it?
I'm guessing,
but
or like, I'm just thinking out loudly. I don't know.
That's what makes sense to me. And like, maybe we're right, maybe we're wrong, but like,
right.
I think, but the concept actually makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So now if you think about an environment and like to piggyback off of what you just said, and this is like directly out of how emotions are made. If you're in a state where your body is making high predictions, you're like a high predictive state, and you're not getting a lot of correction to those predictions for some reason, you're not assimilating corrections.
Mm-hmm.
That is a state that yields chronic pain. So you're predicting that movement is going to be uncomfortable. There's no physiological, mm-hmm. there's nothing physiologically that is, there is, say, if you're a in a
structure,
state of,
there's nothing wrong.
You have low back pain, and it's like objectively mm-hmm. asymptomatic, but you're experiencing pain. So that's a state where your body, your brain is predicting that movement causes pain.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of objective pathology means that you is somehow not getting into your brain mm-hmm. to say that, hey, this actually doesn't, this hurt. Actually isn't yeah. a problem. This, mm-hmm. this isn't a problem. This doesn't hurt. So you have high prediction state with low correction.
Uh-huh,
and that uh-huh. high prediction, low correction is like,
is the circle that you
is
keep
the cycle
going around,
of
right?
Like, of yeah. like it, you know, when I turn my shoulders, it hurts my back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And even though there's nothing that's actually getting hurt, like mm-hmm. like nerve wise, right? Like no nerves are being like, are being insulted, but you are experiencing that pain.
Mm-hmm.
So what we then can do from this high prediction, low correction is meeting somebody in that state and starting to very slowly introduce correction into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when someone comes in and they've had chronic pain and their pain gets relieved, I think that what we're actually doing is we're disrupting a bad prediction correction cycle with new information, and we're providing easy to integrate information because we're doing it outside of like a full body, like, you know, someone's not up and moving around, like we're doing it in a very controlled environment. And so in that controlled environment, that information becomes easier to integrate, and then we can develop new, and then they can start to develop new sensations, among which it's likely to be a reduction in pain.
Right. Love it. Okay. Yeah.
So that here's where shit gets fucking wild for me.
We need sound clips.
This needs to be in video,
something.
Right? Yeah.
Yes,
like there, yes. yeah, this is like, here's where the galaxy brain stuff happens.
Right. Exactly.
So if our job is to introduce errors into a prediction cycle,
mm-hmm.
then everything we do with our clients counts as there can have a therapeutic effect, not just mm-hmm. hands-on stuff. Everything, you could go like even like way out there and just be like, oh, by charging more money for this, like think about the blind test on a bottle of wine, where you tell somebody that like this is a very, very expensive bottle of wine, and they experience it as a very expensive, very great bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this guy's charging me $500 for a session. This is gonna like is gonna work. And self-fulfilling prophecy.
And it does.
So you start to do this. Yeah, yeah. Right. It's
yeah.
And so like you can start to use every single place that you interact with a client, the friction that someone has to overcome in order to book you mm-hmm. becomes the becomes the word that becomes yeah, like becomes part itself. Of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Like mm-hmm. the waiting list, the yeah. fact that it's like, oh, my books are full, but you can join my waiting list. That yeah. has a, that can have a therapeutic effect. And nice. So like, so then we get into like, so it's like, this is the part where it's like, it really is like absolutely like eye-opening for me of like, you know, maybe we can, like one of the things that I talk a lot about with, and I do a lot with my clients is, you know, some people really want to like, they want to get educated. Like I'll have Trail Guide to the Body open and we'll go through it together. You're like, oh, so I think this is going on and this is like, and like all this stuff together. And that has a therapeutic effect because then they understand physiologically, or they can wrap their minds around physiologically what might be happening in their body.
Mm-hmm.
Some people like for some people, that's like, that's really important. For mm-hmm. some people, like other things are important. And it's like, and now you get to be completely ambivalent and indifferent, like not indifferent to the work itself, but you can be everything when everything becomes the work, you can yep. be conscious about all of these things. So we can start to get like, one of the things that I think some of the best therapists do innately is they'll ask questions about someone's experience. Oh, like your back hurts. What is the back like? Or your knee hurts. Is it a sharp pain? Is it a dull pain? Does it ache? When we introduce those other languages to it, right? Like if I'm in pain and I come in, yeah, my knee just hurts. I come in, my knee hurts. I have a thing. But then a great therapist is going to help you. Like part of their intake is going to identify, okay, what makes it better? What makes it worse? What is the sensation like? Does it spread? Does it move? Is it changing? And then you can start to like, you can create a wider language, or you can mm-hmm. help a client create a wider language, which is itself therapeutic. So right. it's like you, it's just like this book opened up this I just kind of started on this path and was just like, it's like, oh, I think this is how the work works.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for more about the like, predictive coding from me, probably from Eddie as well, from some other folks. There's some really, really cool research that's being done, and I think that we know enough that we can start to apply this into our practices. Mm-hmm. And that's what my ambition over the next 6 months is to really help people apply this in their practice in a very real yeah. way that bridges, that honors the work that they've done to like with techniques and the work that they've done to create great rapport with their clients, that gives them a very clear vision of how that affects their clients therapeutically. And that's where I think there's like, I really think there's some like amazing stuff that we can do as body workers. I think we can really expand what we think of as our work mm-hmm. by learning even better what our work is. And like, right. you know, obviously like we can be wrong and it's okay. Cause like, the work still works, even when we don't know why it works, right? Like, like Rolfing worked when we thought it was pulling fascia apart. Like, it's not. It's okay.
Right.
Rolfing still is awesome, right?
Yeah, it still works. It still did help thousands of people. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, this is really interesting. And it kind of, do you remember when we talked about Eddie's course?
Yes.
And you were mentioning that like the technique itself might be different, like how you guys approach things might be exactly the opposite, but somehow it still works for both of you. And this is like, but for me, like, you know, like us talking and working together means that we have like a similar like thinking pattern or like a yep. similar standpoint or perspective on like what we do and how it works. And that's why I think like it doesn't really matter like how you do it or like what you do, it's like how you do it or what's everything around it, who you are as a person, you know, how you talk, how you speak, what you ask questions, like same thing, like that's way more important, or at least as important than knowing like, oh, I'm gonna twist this fascia and do this and this and this to this muscle. I'm like, are you though?
Yeah.
But still, like, the work needs, exactly. So I think this is like a great expansion of like how far we can go and how far we actually go without even knowing it. So I think it's actually better to know.
Yeah. That's the part that gets me is like thinking back to all of the best practitioners that I've ever worked mm-hmm. with. They all did this, and maybe some of them had words for it. I'm sure some of them did. Some of them I'm sure also didn't. I know that some of them didn't.
Yeah.
And what's really cool is like, that's fine.
That's like, fine. Exactly.
And that, you know, obviously there's the baseline of like, you know, everyone has to be at least, you gotta be like competent, but don't do
don't be stupid.
Yeah.
But
once you know that, like once you're in that spot, it's like, everything works. Everything Absolutely. Works. Everything works, but not for everybody.
Yeah,
and that's fine. Like, what was even cooler for me was, you know, I think I've probably mentioned on here, like I try to work fairly lightly. I don't generally. I'm not really like a throw an elbow in something or like make someone groan kind of guy. But I have a couple of clients who like they need to hurt. They need to be like, oh God, that was so intense. They need a moment of that in their session in order for it to feel like a worthwhile session. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh cool, that explains it for me. And now mm-hmm. I can also just, and like therapeutically I couldn't necessarily justify it, but I would do it anyway because like I want them to come back, and they want to come back, and they just want a reason to come back. Oh okay, yeah, I'll do that. And like I'll throw an elbow into someplace, like whatever, it's like it's not it's fine, it's not the part that I think is going to get the biggest change, but through this model, now I can justify it as like I can justify it, and that's pretty exciting for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. Okay. Anything else you want to share from this book?
Nothing except the importance of language and language. The value of like, for me, it was like understanding that people in different cultures, like I'm an English speaker who speaks a handful of a little bit in a bunch of different languages. Mm-hmm. Understanding that in some languages, like there isn't like what we think of as like, we say I'm angry in English. Mm-hmm. There are languages where anger cannot exist as an individual's emotion mm-hmm. or an individual's mm-hmm. feeling. Like anger only, like you can't, there's no language for I'm angry, but there is language for we are angry with each other. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like, and so the, like understanding the limitations of our language where we don't even have a concept, where like there are things that we don't have concepts for that people in other parts of the world, people who speak other languages have those concepts innately. That's the stuff that I think is like really, really important. And I think that like, that gives me just this fire under my ass to like, keep traveling, keep learning, keep spending time with people that aren't like me, because the more you do that, that actually, like, we know that it grows the richness of someone's lived experience, but also there's like a really good reason to do that.
Yeah. So that's amazing. Awesome. Yeah. I think that's a good final sentence, because that's really the importance of what we just talked about. So the book is How Emotions Are Made. And the author is, help me out here, Lisa
Feldman Barrett.
Excellent. So we recommend this book to any body worker. So basically, I would think for anybody.
It's written in a way that's really consumable. I think anybody who's made it this far in this podcast could read it and get down with it.
Excellent. So thank you so much for sharing this. I think we're going to come back to a couple of the points here for sure. I can feel it. Some other podcasts framing out of this. So we're definitely going to come back to this and talk about it more, especially the language. And I'm interested in the triune brain and all that stuff too. So we're going to come back to that, but we're going to leave off this podcast because I think we said a lot of important things and a lot of very, very interesting things. So keep that in mind. For the long term, like if you guys, if anybody have questions or observations or recommendations, what books should we read? Just throw it at us in our emails, and you can also share it with the podcast with your friends and your colleagues. So have at it and give us a good rating on wherever you listen. And thank you all for listening. And when we talk to you and hear you, listen to you next time. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hands at the Table. If you'd like to follow up with us, you can find Bori on Instagram at Bori Suranyi LMT and Jeff on Instagram at Jay Bramhall. If you can leave a review or rating for this podcast anywhere that you listen to your podcasts, we would really appreciate it because that will help other people find the podcast. Thanks, and we'll see you next time at Hands at the Table.